From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, a Milwaukee Latino organization opens a legislative series by focusing on immigration reform. How a Milwaukee woman's story illustrates a broader issue of justice through the years. Director Gil Cates Jr. talks about the script that inspired him to make a movie in Milwaukee.
You know, you get sent scripts or you develop scripts and you're not really expecting every time you start turning the pages that you're going to be attracted. But when I finished it, I just couldn't shake it. I couldn't stop thinking about it.
And the real challenge of writing a play about good nutrition.
Writing something that just says, listen, kids, eating vegetables is good for you. This is what you should do, and this is why it's good, is the easiest way to turn a kid off.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for being with us today. The future of immigration reform efforts in Congress remains in question 2 days after House Speaker John Boehner held a closed-door meeting with leading Republicans to discuss their approach to the measure which passed the Senate earlier this year. With that as the backdrop, members of the Milwaukee group Esperanza Unida will address immigration reform questions to Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson at a forum this evening. It's the first in a series of legislative panels the Latino organization is planning. General Manager Manny Perez joins us on the line now. Welcome to the show.
It's an honor for me to be here with you and to share some opinions and comments in the direction that Esperanza Unida is taking under my leadership.
As an organization that works with Latino workers, does Esperanza Unida have a particular stance on immigration reform?
Well, Esperanza Unida, as a nonprofit organization, really does not have a particular stance towards one thing or another from a political standpoint, okay? Let me share with you several comments in relation to the topic, because the issue of immigration is a complex one. It deals with economic development in Latin America and in other nations. It deals with U.S. industry. It deals with economic development here in the United States, and it deals with social development. So as a result, it really has to be looked at in a comprehensive manner.
Well, and I imagine this is going to be a difficult question to answer without taking a political stance on it, but the immigration reform measure which passed the Senate and has this uncertain future in the House is out there, and I guess I'd be curious to get your take on what ought to be in a comprehensive package when it comes to immigration reform. What are the specific things that need to be addressed? And as someone who works in this area, how do you think those areas would be best addressed?
Let me speak not as the general manager of Esperanza Unida, which is a nonprofit organization, nonpartisan, okay? Let me speak as a labor economist, as an individual who has been very familiarized with the labor issues here in the United States and at the international level. In general, I divide the issue of immigration into three. One, why are people coming to the United States looking for jobs? Two, security. Three, the domestic issues dealing with labor. In my opinion, the current proposals really do not address the issue of why people are coming in to the United States looking for jobs. And that issue has to do because individuals coming from other nations, escaping from poverty, escaping from corruption in other nations. I believe that right now there is a great opportunity. It's a great opportunity to address this issue, to lower the amount of people seeking to come to the United States, if the United States would consider tightening its foreign policy through the World Bank and through the IMF. In other words, in a practical level, tightening. This is what I'm proposing.
Sure.
Tightening the loans that go to emerging markets, so that the loans are directly and more closely related to the achievement of employment outcomes in these nations, towards the achievement of significant reductions in income inequality, and towards the achievement of increases, statistically significant increases in purchasing power parity. Because if you can achieve that, and the World Bank and the IMF can actually do that because they control the money through the loans, then what would you have is better, more employment in these nations, better distributed by lowering the coefficient of inequality, and by virtue of having increased purchasing power, then people can consume more products. That would be a significant benefit to the United States, because these individuals consuming more, they would consume, in general, more products from the United States and other nations, okay? The second portion is really security. There is no way around it. Security at the border must be maintained. However, if you are lowering the number of people coming into the United States by virtue of supporting economic development in other nations, then what would occur is that you can move into what's called managed labor flows. We possess the internet technology already to take a person from Argentina and place that person in Warsaw, Wisconsin. It's easily done through the internet. And I can tell you that it is easily done, because when I was in Manpower and I was in charge of managed services, I was a lead person in the development of solutions at the international level to design a system where a person could come from another country, be relocated here, obtain, for example, the papers, and then be placed. Therefore, a worker in Mexico could actually be placed in Warsaw to work in a legal manner. So from a security standpoint, that must be implemented, and we possess the technology to achieve that. Then the third portion is what to do with the individuals that are here. Well, the individuals that are here, yes, they have broken the law in terms of being here illegally, but so have the employers who have hired them for many years. So if we're going to sanction those individuals, it seems to me that it would be the first thing that everybody that has incurred in the portion would be need to be sanctioned. Certainly from a human standpoint, and I think everybody tends to agree, that you really cannot adopt the position of we're going to get them out of here in 1 second, simply because it's just not feasible. So the proper thing to do would likely be to have a negotiated solution where these individuals an amount for breaking the law, and at the same time having a path to citizenship after demonstrated that they are going to be contributing members of society, including learning English, including having skills that are in demand here in the United States, but also employers who have hired individuals that are undocumented need to abide by the law. In other words, this is not a one-shot solution. It's a solution that has many parts.
Is there a particular message you're hoping to get across to Senator Johnson when he speaks to your group this evening?
Well, the object of this, and I'm speaking now as a general manager of Esperanza Unida, the object of the meeting is precisely to offer an opportunity for members of the grassroots communities to have the opportunity to interact with Senator Johnson and propose practical ideas to him, and for him to interact directly with individuals from the grassroots community to express his ideas and then come to terms and really come put our heads together to arrive at solutions. So tomorrow's meeting really is not my meeting. It's a meeting of the people coming together. Esperanza Unida seeks to create a forum of civic discussion where individuals can interact with their leaders of all the political spectrum. In fact, we're inviting leaders from the Democratic Party, from business leaders to participate in this legislative speaker series for the purpose of motivating civic discussion in actual resolution of problems.
Well, Manny Perez, I thank you so much and wish you best of luck with your work.
Thank you very much. Thank you. You take care.
Manny Perez is the general manager of Esperanza Unida. Wisconsin Republican Senator Ron Johnson will speak about immigration reform issues at the Milwaukee Latino Group's first event in a legislative speakers series this evening at the group's headquarters on West National. A quick break now, and then a Madison writer helps a remarkable Milwaukee woman tell her story of a lifetime's search for justice. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. On a February night in 1958, Milwaukee police tried to pull over an African-American motorist on the city's north side. Police at the scene said after trying to evade them, the driver jumped out of the car and lunged at officers with a knife. They shot and killed Daniel Bell at the scene. Family members, though, believed a cover-up shielded what really happened that night, and a startling admission by a police officer 2 decades later confirmed their fears, and it resulted in a significant financial settlement with Bell's survivors. But for Bell's sister, Sylvia Bell White, her brother's injustice at the hands of police was just one part of a lifetime in which inequality swirled around her. But her life has also been marked by resilience. Sylvia Bell White's story is told in a new book by Madison writer and historian Jody LePage, who used hours of oral history interviews. Each chapter is divided between LePage's historical analysis and Sylvia's stories told in her own words. LePage, who will share the story in Milwaukee on Saturday, joins us on the line from Madison this morning. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you very much. Thanks for inviting me.
Why do you think it is important for people to know Sylvia Bell White's story?
Well, I think it has several levels of importance. For Milwaukee, of course, the Daniel Bell case is very important for the city of Milwaukee. Every time a new questionable incident occurs, people talk again about the Daniel Bell case because it's just one of those unusual instances when what really happened came out, which rarely does happen in these instances. So there's always all this doubt about them. But I also think that the book is very important because Sylvia wanted to tell her whole life story, which has a very wide scope. It spans from grandparents born in slavery to the first African-American president of the United States. And it begins in the segregated South with several chapters about what it was like to live there as a child through the Depression and World War II, and comes up through the present.
How did you start learning it? You, if I have the chronology right, have known Sylvia for 40 years.
That's right. I met Sylvia when we both were selling vegetables at the farmer's market in 1973. At the time, I thought she was just a few years older than me. We were just casual friends. I thought she was one of the most fun people I had ever met. And so any chance I got, I would get over to her stand and talk with her. And then I soon was back in school and no longer selling vegetables at the farmer's market, but she was, and so I'd come and visit her and stayed in touch with her over the years, partly through correspondence. Later, she was selling only in Milwaukee, and I encountered her there when I was going to UWM myself. And so we just stayed in touch over the years, and it was really after the Milwaukee Repertory Theater did a play about the Daniel Bell case that Sylvia asked me if I would help her write her life story. It took quite a while after that because I had just I was just enrolled in the PhD program here in Madison in French history. I was in a different field altogether. But when I finished, we just ended up doing this book.
Well, and the conversations that that drive the story, I gather, played out over several years. When did it all start to coalesce into the book it became?
It's an oral history project, so we knew from the start that we were going to have Sylvia telling her own story. We made most of the tapes in 1998. We made a few others later when she would tell me some story that was longer and really needed to be captured on tape. But she also told me some things when we would meet. She would drive over here to meet me at Memorial Library at the University of Wisconsin here in Madison. And we would meet once a week and discuss my research as I was beginning to read in order to frame her chapters in their historical context, to put some history with her chapters so that people would have a better understanding of what she was talking about. Some of her narrative emerged in those meetings also. I would just take notes if she would say something that was particularly interesting. Her narrative, most of it is on tape, not every little scrap of it, though.
Sure.
I had just completed a PhD in history, so I was interested in framing the story in its historical context. So it has quite a historical sweep.
And of course, the underlying theme that runs through much of this book is the injustice towards African Americans that surrounded Sylvia and the people around her at many points in her life. So what can you tell us about her childhood in the South and what she was dealing with there?
Well, she grew up where segregation was both by law and by custom. It was a part of their lives, whether it was walking into town and going into the store, or not being allowed to go into any restaurants, or probably the most important dimension of it in Sylvia's life as a child was that where she grew up, there was no school for black children, only a school for white children. And so the children in her community only had a school because their parents created one. They pooled what little money they could. They got a room in the church and hired a teacher, just one teacher for the entire community, which meant as many as 100 children, actually of all ages and all levels. And then only when the parents could spare the children's work in the field. So that was the most important thing to those children, was that they really received no education. That Sylvia did manage to learn to read and write, as did a couple others of her brothers. But this was an issue for Daniel Bell, who did not have a Wisconsin driver's license because he couldn't pass the written part of the Wisconsin driver's test. And his family feels quite certain that that's why Dan ran away when he was pulled over by the police in Milwaukee.
So let's flash forward, because she moved and some of her relatives moved from the Jim Crow South to what you write, some described as the James Crow North, and settled in Milwaukee. What were people getting at when they described the situation in Milwaukee and other places in the North as James Crow?
Well, I think what they were just saying was that it was slightly more polite form, or a less overt form of racial discrimination that they were encountering. I think that Sylvia was young when she came to Milwaukee and therefore had very high hopes. I think people came from the segregated South expecting the North to be a place where the kinds of situations they encountered in the South would not confront them. And instead they found that they encountered job discrimination, housing discrimination, and personal forms of discrimination. And of course, in the instance of Daniel Bell, it's an example of discrimination in policing. So they felt that they encountered some of the same basic problems. It was just less overt. There weren't laws saying that African Americans couldn't enter spaces such as restaurants and so forth, or that kind of open. There was certainly far less lynching in the North, although it did occur here also.
Well, and you mentioned employment discrimination. We actually have a clip of tape of Sylvia Bell White talking about what she saw pretty much every day as she lived in Milwaukee. But before we hear, what can you tell us about what her aspirations were and what she really encountered?
Well, as was the case with many African Americans, she thought when she came to Milwaukee, since it had a booming manufacturing sector at that time, that she would be able to get a good job in a Milwaukee factory. Although what she really hoped to do more than anything else was to have a nursing career, so she hoped to get an education and be able to have that nursing career also over time. But what she hoped when she first arrived was that she'd be able to get a good job in a Milwaukee factory. And manufacturing was really booming in the city at that time.
We'll hear this clip of tape where she talks about living essentially right near a very large bakery and essentially learning that there's no way in the world that she's going to get a job there.
Yes.
I could see all the people, all these. I don't want to really emphasize a white, but all these white people would be walking down the streets on Monday morning. It would be just droves of them. And I said, where are they going, Auntie? She said, they are going to Yerga's Bakery, right up under us. I mean, it was a nice little black community in there. I would say, oh my God, look at all those people. And then she would tell me, well, they're going to work. To work? Maybe I can get me a job over there. She said, not hardly.
The killing of her brother by a Milwaukee policeman in 1958 was obviously one of the most significant moments in her life and the life of her family. What I thought was interesting was it represents a fairly small portion of the book itself.
Yes, she didn't want the book to be exclusively focused on the Daniel Bell case. She really wanted it to be about her whole life, and that life covers a lot of other ground. And certainly the Daniel Bell incident, it is part of the whole story. It never really leaves her mind, of course. And it's true that it's concentrated in a couple of chapters, and then there are threads through the book that connect with the Daniel Bell case. But Sylvia really wanted this to be a larger story. It's about larger issues of race in America, and also about a woman's life, the life of a rather adventurous person who braved the things that others might not try, and who pushed the limits, on, particularly limits imposed by racism. So she wanted to really tell her whole life story.
Well, and as we, you know, as we tend to do in this country, we might think that after the civil rights movement, everything got better. She left for California and came back to Wisconsin. What has driven the last few decades of her life in Wisconsin, and what were the kinds of justice issues she experienced in, you know, the time since really the time since you've known her?
This is the main point, really, that Sylvia wanted to make with this book, is that for as long as her life is, and as much time as it covers, and as much change as she's seen in her life, racial injustice really remains a major problem in American society. She certainly speaks in her last chapter about the voting issues that arose in the 2000 presidential election, where a lot of African Americans were deprived of their vote. And I think she became increasingly interested in telling a story that reached beyond herself and her own family and her brothers to that larger picture of what life has been like for African Americans in this country, in a country where Sylvia very much feels identified as an American and very much took this country at its word when she was a teenager in World War II and heard a lot of talk about the American way, as opposed to the kind of racism that Hitler and the Nazis were known for.
One of the things I thought was particularly interesting was the idea that you chose to transcribe her stories in a way that really captures her style of speaking, her dialect. Was that at all an issue for you?
It wasn't really an issue for me. I knew from the start that I wanted to have her speech be as authentic as possible. It got a little bit tricky because she would have liked it to be corrected more. She is very aware of her lack of education as a child, and we had that discussion at one point after she had seen the manuscript of her own narrative and wanted me to correct the English more, and I balked, and we had to have this discussion about it. But I knew from the start that I really wanted to have it be Sylvia speaking in her own words, and I think that is part of the power of the book, really.
What also struck me was, given all of the stuff life has thrown at Sylvia, she doesn't come off seeming, I hate to use this word, but she doesn't seem bitter.
She's not. It's one of the most impressive things about Sylvia is that she's just remains this very loving, good person, very outgoing, very ready to meet and enjoy people, to really love them. I really traced some of that back to the father who raised those children, who I think really taught them that you demonstrate your dignity. This was in the segregated South, a very degrading and oppressive situation, but that you demonstrate your dignity by following your own understanding of right and wrong and what you feel is the way you should behave, rather than letting anyone else's ugly behavior determine your behavior.
Well, it is a remarkable story, and she seems like a remarkable person. And Jody LePage, thank you so much for sharing the story with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
Jody LePage is the co-author, along with Sylvia Bell White, of the book Sister, An African-American Life in Search of Justice, published by the University of Wisconsin Press. She'll talk about the book tomorrow afternoon at the Wisconsin African-American Women's Center in Milwaukee. Another quick break now, and in just a moment, we'll learn about a feature film about to begin production on Lake Michigan. Really, it will be produced on Lake Michigan. This is Lake Effect from WUWF. Thank you. Earth Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Milwaukee has done a lot to attract different water-related professionals and industries to the region to take advantage of the Great Lakes. Scientists, freshwater equipment companies, and even water law experts are all doing business here. But one area that has not been part of the equation has been the film industry, at least until now. Milwaukee and Lake Michigan will play key roles in a major motion picture that will begin filming here later this month. The Surface is written and produced by Milwaukee's Jeff Gendelman, a veteran of television and film work. It's directed by Gil Cates Jr., who's co-producer of the Steve Jobs movie due out nationally in August. Gendelman and Cates are in the studio with us to share the story. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you, Mitch.
Thanks, Mitch.
What attracted both of you to this story and this project? I mean, this is your story, so why don't we start with you, Jeff?
Yeah, thank you, Mitch. 18 years ago, I had the concept, back in the mid-90s. And for the next 5 years or so, we started to develop it in living in Los Angeles. Over the next 10 years after that, it got put into the back seat because of other projects coming up. And over the last 5 years, I've been developing it daily, actually nightly, from 9:30 p.m. to 12:30 a.m., just about every night in the last 5 years. Over a year ago, a year and a half ago, a mutual friend of Gil and mine's in Los Angeles named Randy Arney, the artistic director of the Geffen Playhouse, he read the script and said, Jeff, you should talk to Gil. This would be perfect for him. And at that point, Mitch, I have been looking at many, many directors. And Gil read it, and he called me immediately.
Gil Cates Jr., why is this the perfect script for you?
Well, as Jeff said, Randy sent me the script, and you know, you get sent scripts or you develop scripts, and you're not really expecting every time you start turning the pages that you're going to be attracted. But when I finished it, I just couldn't shake it. I couldn't stop thinking about it. There was something about these characters of Mitch, this is one of the leads, Mitch and Kelly. There was something about the two of them and the journey they go on that I just found universal in its theme, and I hadn't seen anything or read anything quite like this. So really, it's just I couldn't not want to talk more about it. It kind of just sucked me in. I wasn't looking for, and I never do. Oh well, how much is the budget? Oh well, how much? It's just none of that stuff matters. It's just the story and telling a good story, and that's what this is—a good story.
Well, we should tell the story to some degree. This is a movie that exists on paper. It exists in your heads. Give us a thumbnail sketch of how the story plays out.
It's about two strangers, both at the end of their rope, who suddenly meet in the middle of the unpredictable waters of Lake Michigan. It's an adventure drama. It's about how even on the darkest days there's light, how tomorrow's a new day, how even when you are just got to let go in order to hang on.
The story first struck you. You said you've been working on this really for 18 years. Where did it come from? What inspired it?
I think what happened was I actually grew up in Milwaukee in the inner city for the first 5-6 years of my life. And then when my dad started doing a little bit better in business, we moved to the North Shore. This was in the early 60s. We moved right near Lake Michigan, a block away. I think I went down to the beach every single day, or at least the hill on top of the beach to overlook, to see this ocean, if you will, of a body of water. And at about that time, 5-6 years old, was the first time I saw Godzilla. And it got me thinking, as I would take my daily treks down to the lake to say hello to it, what's out there in the middle? What's going on out there? Because we cannot see across that 80 miles to the state of Michigan. So I think that was the seed for the premise, which was developed in the mid-90s, and the premise is the same. The script, of course, has gone through 85 different drafts over the years, but the premise has always stayed the same. What's out there?
And it had to be Lake Michigan.
It had to be Lake Michigan. In fact, through the years, different directors wanted to do it in New Jersey, in Florida, parts of Canada. But even though I wasn't living in Milwaukee, I was in Los Angeles and New York City for the bulk of the last 35 years. I wanted to make sure that it was a Milwaukee story. Even though it was universally themed, it will show Milwaukee and Lake Michigan and Southeast Wisconsin wonderfully throughout the world. It'll teach people about our area. It'll educate people about Lake Michigan, how it's really turned around, how the water is much better quality than it used to be. and how it really does change moment to moment. And it can be more dangerous than the Atlantic Ocean.
Gil Cates, Jr., you're, I imagine, not in this to necessarily educate people about Milwaukee and about Lake Michigan, but...
How do you know, Mitch?
I don't. I shouldn't
assume
things.
You don't know me,
Mitch. but how much do you have to wrap your head around what Lake Michigan means to this film?
Well, what I liked about – one of the things I liked about the script, I wouldn't want to shoot it anywhere else but here because, you know, I understand – I'm sure some of the people in the past, you know, Canada has tax credits and New Jersey closer to maybe some more talent for the film. But that's what makes this film – that's what gives it its personality is Lake Michigan. We went out last Wednesday and did a camera test with this water stabilization equipment, and we start shooting the end of the month. It's important to make sure when – and I'll get back to answer your question – that when you're shooting on the water, just because the waves are going like this, even in the movie, if you want rocky waters, you have to be able to control the environment to create rocky waters. You can't just go out there and – you know, you have actors. And so we went out there and we tested the stabilization, which is amazing. It kind of like counterbalances with the water, so your frame kind of stays centered. And when I was out there, I just realized it has to be here. It has to be here. When you do in the film, when he departs and goes into the water, you don't want to see some big city behind. It's important. It's part of the movie.
Jeff Gendelman, we've learned why Milwaukee, why Lake Michigan. Were there people that inspired Mitch and Kelly?
Yeah, the events in the screenplay are based on true experiences. Of course, there's dramatic license to craft the screenplay. But yes, many of the events in the story did take place.
And I don't know how much you want to share about the story itself, but can you explain how these guys happen to be in the middle of Lake Michigan?
Sure. Yeah,
you don't often run into people in the middle of the lake.
Correct. And that's part of the intrigue. The story is framed where we begin with Mitch, and we know he's up to something and he's not in good shape mentally. He puts an intent forward. We're watching him do something. And he eventually winds his way down to McKinley Marina with this 20-foot fishing-slash-ski boat, about 30-years-old boat. And he launches it, and he throttles down. He's going out into the middle of the lake. We don't know what's going on. We're just following him, the first 8 to 9 minutes of the movie. And he is going underneath the boat, under the steering column, to grab something. And as he's bending over, he sees over the edge of the boat some debris from a crashed small-engine float plane where someone is draped over one of the pontoons. So he motors over and he realizes the man is seriously injured. He brings him on board. He's unconscious at that point. And he now realizes he has to save him. But in throttling to pick a direction to go back to shore, he's already 40 miles out in the middle of the lake. He runs out of gas immediately. So what happens then over the course of the next 85 minutes is that these two are at each other's throats at the beginning of the story because Kelly, the gentleman who crashed this plane, who's dying basically on camera, Mitch has to save him. Kelly realizes through dialogue and flashback that Mitch actually went out to the lake to commit suicide. Kelly has to stay alive to keep Mitch alive. Mitch has to stay alive to keep Kelly alive. And we're actually watching this character of Kelly, which we've never seen before in motion pictures, literally die on camera through the use of special effects makeup. We're bringing in this amazing gentleman named Dean Jones from Los Angeles, who's done many, many, many films. Watching this person die, who we become very involved with and start to care of both these characters. And in the end, Mitch, they become each other's guardian angels. The visual special effect that we in the audience and Mitch watching this guy that he's now trying to help. And in so doing, Mitch has his own renaissance.
Are they the only two actors, the only two characters in the film?
No, there's more. I mean, there's, you know, 7 to 10, you know, actors, some more prominent than other. But the majority of the film is the two of them on the lake. I mean, the opening of the movie, the closing of the movie, flashbacks, that doesn't take place on water. But probably 85%, maybe 90% does take place just on the water with these two.
Are you able to film all of this out on Lake Michigan?
We are. We're going to – I mean, I'll let Jeff expand, but we are able to – you know, there's certain times we're going to have to shoot close to shore because of the water and the nature of it, and we'll have to – you know, there's ways to accomplish that. I've been watching a lot of films from Open Water to Dead Calm to Hitchcock's Lifeboat, Knife in the Water, and it's really interesting to see how these various movies accomplish – you know, once you establish where you are, I think there's some creative license to how you do it. But then there's times we're going to be 10, 20 miles deep because we have to be completely, you know, we're looking all around them and not seeing anything but the two of these guys in the water. So
I gather you have at least one of the stars on board. Is that right?
Yeah, we do. Sean Astin is attached to play Mitch. Sean is a great actor. He's been working his whole life. I've actually known Sean since I was a kid. We interacted when I was young, and this is coincidentally because Jeff came to me, and this is the first person that we wanted to go to. Jeff said, we had a list of actors. Let's make an offer to Sean Astin first. And it's not often when you make a film, the first offer you make is the actor you get. And it just coincidentally, I knew Sean, and my dad directed his mother in a few films, I think three. And it's just great. I'm so happy he responded to the material. I couldn't be happier.
And you're still casting Kelly, is that right?
Correct. We have an offer out now, but you know, until these things close, but we expect to have our Kelly, within the next week. And then there's a couple other key speaking roles versus some of the featured extras that will be cast as well. But yeah, the movie will be as soon as we have our Kelly, we have our Mitch and our Kelly, and then kind of just casting around those two.
Well, and it all has to gear up pretty fast because, as you say, you're filming the end of this month.
We are in pre-production right now. So the assistant directors, the second assistant directors, everybody is in town now. And in the next few weeks, we'll continue with pre-production.
You know, there was a lot that was made a few years ago about the tax incentive program that existed to bolster the film industry in Wisconsin, and then the program ended. What do you see as the challenges to making a movie in a place that's, you know, it's not only not the center of the film industry, but it's not really on the ring road around the center of the film industry?
At the end of the day, for me, it's about passionate people making the film. So regardless, you know, if you're in L.A., maybe you would have a few areas of the, you know, in the crew where you could look at a resume and see they have 20 films versus two. But if they're people that care about the project, those are the people that we want to be talking to. You know, we just met someone the other day who's going to be our production designer, art director, and she's done more commercials, more, you know, a lot of other things, but she loves the pro, you know, that kind of stuff really matters. So there's certainly challenges in finding crew, and, you know, there's certain areas that Jeff touched upon, the special effects, where there are some people that have to be like the sound shooting on the water. You know, we have to make sure we're getting the best person possible. The special effect, because that is a character in the movie. Watching Kelly die is a character in the movie in itself. And then there's other people that maybe we're going to bring in from Chicago, or, you know, Jimmy, our DP, who's shot a lot in town. So it is a challenge to find, but we're finding it.
Well, Gil Cates Jr., Jeff Gendelman, thank you so much and best of luck with this.
Thanks, Mitch.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Gil Cates Jr. is director, and Jeff Gendelman, the writer and producer of a film called The Surface, slated to begin production in Milwaukee later this month. It'll feature Sean Astin in a starring role and a co-star to be named soon. There is a link to more information, including how you can be involved in the process, from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. One last break, and when we return, good nutrition takes center stage, literally. We'll tell you more on Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Everyone knows we should be eating more fresh foods, especially vegetables and fruits, but as difficult as it can be to get adults to eat what they should, it's often even harder to convince kids. And for many kids, just getting access to fresh foods is tough. So connecting families with farms and other local whole food resources is the goal of Milwaukee Public Theater's traveling summer show. It's called Out to Lunch, the Fresh Food Variety Show. The original work by local playwright Neil Haven uses sketches, physical comedy, and puppets to help kids and their families learn about healthy eating, urban gardening, and more. It's traveling around the metro area through early August, playing outdoors in parks and playgrounds. Bo Johnson directed the show, which was the brainchild of MPT's co-founder and artistic director Barbara Lee and administrative coordinator Katarina Wren. All three joined Lake Effect's Bonnie North in the studio, and Lee explains why they chose this subject matter.
We became concerned because of all the statistics of what happens to people when they're not eating good food. It leads to violence, it leads to obesity, it leads to emotional instability, all kinds of bad things. So we thought to create a show about it would be really important. We also really wanted to reach kids because kids are the ones that probably suffer the most, but they also really impact their parents. I mean, they can say what they want. They can help to steer what's going on, and we wanted to empower them. So the show is very much of a fun show, but it also incorporates lots of information and opportunities for kids to interact and actually take part in a quiz show. And then there's a workshop afterwards where they get to move around a lot. They get to express themselves physically and also create some craft elements that relate to the whole food theme.
So, Bo, how are you putting this on stage? It sounds sort of vaudevillian.
It is. It's sort of a sketch show, and it's very slapsticky and kind of broad comedy, as well as some I think really fun puppetry. We've got one particular scene that's just backyard chickens, and they're all puppets sort of sitting on a fence and trying to figure out if one of the chickens is a hen or a rooster because it hasn't gotten old enough yet that you can really tell. So there's a mystery. And Dan Catula, a good friend of mine who's an excellent puppet maker and puppeteer, made these particular puppets, and they're really great. They're fun to watch. The actors are doing a great job with the puppetry. So that's just one of the sketches. Then there's another kind of mystery sketch about, you know, missing raspberries and who might have picked the raspberries out of the backyard, which probably a lot of people in Milwaukee go through on a yearly basis every summer. Who picked raspberries?
Where did they go? I was planning to make jam.
Yeah. Somebody picked them, either the bunnies or some guy.
Yeah.
So my friend Neil Haven, that did the writing, really had, I think, an excellent sort of perspective on the fact that writing something that just says, listen, kids, eating vegetables is good for you. This is what you should do and this is why it's good is the easiest way to turn a kid off. So it's much more written from the perspective of these are characters that are fun and likable and they really like eating vegetables and they like growing their own food and they enjoy doing it. We're not saying that you have to do it, but, you know, be entertained by watching these people who you like, who are really into homegrown food and into gardening. And if you identify with them, there's a good chance that you then are going to go home and feel like, oh, that might be a fun thing to do. So we so steered away from doing anything that might come across as preachy. We really didn't want to do that.
So I know the show's only gone on a few times as of now, and it's going on all summer in various places. What has been the response so far? Have kids responded to it, and have parents responded to it?
Oh, yes.
Well, interestingly enough, we were doing a dress rehearsal in a park a couple of days before the show actually opened, and we were just doing it to get a feel for, you know, how loud do you have to be out of doors and, you know, how are you going to deal with the sun and where are you going to change costumes? And a whole crowd of people in the park that we were working in, which was Carver's Park, I think, just as they were walking by, just stopped and were like, oh, that's kind of fun. And then the next thing we knew, they sat down and all of a sudden we had 20 people that were watching. The kids seemed to really enjoy it. And then I was at the opening performance, which was at Johnson's Park as part of the Fondy Farmers Market event.
Insight, yeah.
Site. And that went well, except for we were dealing with really high winds. So those parts of the performance that were not getting blown over seem to be going really
people
well.
People seem to enjoy it.
People yeah, seem to enjoy it.
That's the trick about outdoor theater of any kind is you're dealing with the elements.
Yeah.
Yes.
You
yeah.
have no control over that, really. You sort of mitigate as best you can.
Right.
But, yeah. So logistically, Katarina, how is all of this happening, and what partners are you and Barbara working with to get this into the communities?
Oh, it's been exciting because there are so many people doing good work as far as the urban gardening movement and wellness programs. We've been working with Victor Garden Initiative. Alice's Garden has been especially inspiring because they've got wellness programming and community gardening. A lot of respect that New Life runs, which is a garden that was initiated by kids. And so now they're in, I believe it's their fourth year. And so there's kid investment. There's neighborhood investment. And Milwaukee Public Theater has always been big on collaboration. And I think that adds so much texture to what we do because we're an outreach theater company, but we do anything having to do with the arts. And so any of these social service agencies or gardening agencies that we've been able to connect with, they've been providing us with information. So when I started to work on the resource guide, I took the playwright around to all these different sites, like the Urban Ecology Center and Victor Garden Initiative, Concordia Gardens, Alice's Garden. So many, yeah, Hunger Task Force has a farm. That was a really fun visit that we took. And they're doing cooking classes. So the idea was, how can we highlight the work that they're doing? So many groups are starting gardens. And so as we get kids excited about being outside and learning about eating healthier, we also want to make sure that they learn about how that food enlivens their movement. So getting them active, but not just saying, hey, you need to eat your vegetables, you need to exercise, but really making it an invitation for a lifestyle.
And so I assume also that in addition to the performance, which that's the fun part, it brings people in, but then are you guiding people to these other groups that are actually providing garden space and techniques and
yes.
knowledge? Okay, so there's a follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. That
and we've
happens.
Got our movement workshops, really using the various arts disciplines that we can to communicate the message, because the more you engage with kids in whatever their learning style is, the greater the chances are of exciting them to make healthier choices.
The other thing we're doing is we have workshops right after the show that are movement workshops that reinforce the theme about where does your energy come from. Guess what? It's from food. Well, the sun helps and water help a lot. And then we also have a crafts workshop where they're making little pots to plant things in. And then we have longer residencies in five different neighborhoods. So we're working with kids in much greater depth for particular arts disciplines, but also reinforcing the theme. We've been exploring a whole curriculum that deals with food, gardening, nurturing, and peace. We're really connecting this with violence prevention as well, because people don't make that connection normally. It's like, well, violence happens over here. No, no, no. It happens inside. It happens when you're not feeling like you're in control, and so you lash out. So there's a lot of unexpected connections that we're really kind of pulling together. In fact, we're working with the Violence Prevention Initiative from the Medical College on this as well, so that there is that connection with the larger picture.
Violence prevention, is that also part of this whole theater work through the summer, or is that something that's sort of in addition to this particular program?
It's not directly a part of the show, for example, although I'm sure that our characters could get really mad at each other about stealing raspberries, but they work it out very peacefully. But we are working with Mary Ryan Boys and Girls Club, for example, and we're doing one of our residencies there, and it's focusing on Summer of Peace. It's focusing on creating elements for the Summer of Peace parade and rally, and it's making the food connection, but in that context.
When we were coming up with our curriculum, we thought it was very important to focus on peacemaking activities. We have yoga. We even have a little bit of meditation, martial arts, crafts. Because when you look at the themes of planting and growth, there's such a wealth of material to explore. And when you're tackling a theme like resilience, and building healthy kids, there are so many metaphors that can be used in artistic ways. So we really got inspired.
So, Bo, for you, working in this, it's like we were saying, it's all outside, and mm-hmm. your job is to entertain first and foremost as
right.
well as teach. So what were some specific challenges to making that happen?
Well, same kind of challenge as directing really any show, making sure that it's paced in a way that where it doesn't come across as too slow or go faster than a young audience can really follow. So there was probably more physical work in this show than I have to deal with in a lot of more adult shows.
Once the summer of shows is over, and obviously kids are out of school, so it's easier to get them to parks and that sort of thing, is there an idea, Barbara, that you're going to take this that you've worked on this summer and bring it into the school year and take it around to schools as well?
We haven't thought about taking it into schools, but we definitely have thought about trying to do it again next summer and expand on what we've been doing. So it's always a trick to change a show in mid-course, as mm-hmm. we've been talking about with Bo. So any changes, any major changes that we want to make, we would definitely do next year. But then we also want to build in more opportunities to explore this theme in other ways. We've been, as I said, we were exploring this new curriculum, and it's such a vast network, a concept that we need time to develop it, and we need to work with our artist teachers more about what works for them, what didn't work for them, how we can really hone this into a really comprehensive program. Because I think it has huge potential. It's going to take a little time.
I'd like to add that we work in after school with after school groups all year round. So because of the fact that we do these residencies that have physical movement, dance, martial arts, as well as the arts disciplines, I think that this theme will be coming up more and more in the work that we do during the school year. And we really want to experiment with the curriculum that we've developed, because it's really about exploring that mind-body-spirit connection, getting kids to inhabit their bodies, getting connected, taking up residence in their own bodies and feeling empowered with the food choices that they make, with the physical activities that they do, so that they're making other choices. We have to give them alternatives. If we don't want kids getting into trouble, we have to give them something that gets them high on life, so to speak.
Well, I want to thank all of you for coming in today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Barbara Lee is co-founder and artistic director of the Milwaukee Public Theater. Katarina Wren is the administrative coordinator. Bo Johnson directed the company's newest show, Out to Lunch, the Fresh Food Variety Show, which is playing at an area park near you through early August. There's a link to more information, including where to download the Food for Thought resource guide at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. That is another week's worth of Lake Effects, produced by Dan Harmon, Bonnie North, and Stephanie Lecce, with Amy Kiley and our production assistants Eleanor Peterson, Gabby Magallanes, Nathan Royster, and Rachel Bloom. I'm Mitch Teich. Go have something really healthy to eat and join us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.